Romans 1:17 through 1:32. The third talk in a series on Romans was presented by Jack Crabtree on October 12, 2004 at McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2004. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
What I call Section 3, Part 1 of the body of the argument of the letter. We're out of the introduction now. But before I get there, I do want to spend just a little bit more time on the last statement that he makes at the end of the introduction. I have it on good authority that what I was saying about that last week was difficult to follow without something in writing. So I put something in writing. Those are the notes that you have on the interpretation of Romans 1:17, chapter 1, verse 17. It's my paragraph 7, sentence 4 and 5. So I've tried to reproduce it literally for you at the top of the page there. Now in it, the dikaiosune of God is revealed, and I have revealed in quotes. And now I'm including the Greek here because my argument is about how to take this Greek. Those of you who know Greek, I haven't declined the word, the noun. I know that it needs to be declined, but I'm trying to keep it simple. So it's ek pisteos, but the word is pistis. Ek pistis, ace piston, so the noun is piston, and pistis means faith or belief. It's often translated faith in our Bibles, but it's really not a religious word. It's a plain old ordinary off the street word for believing something. Pistis is when you have beliefs that some assertion is true, that it's the case. So now in it, the dikaiosune of God is revealed, ek pistis, ace pistis, just as it is written, the one who is dikaios, ek pistis, shall live. Now the challenge in understanding this assertion by Paul is how are we to take these Greek words here, ek pistis, ace pistis, dikaiosune, and dikaios, ek pistis. So I have some interpretive data that have led me to my interpretation, and that's what I tried to go over last week, but it was a little bit too quick. There's four things we need to keep in mind. The first one is the meaning of the word that I keep as reveal in my text here, but that's the question, is what exactly does that mean? My contention would be that to reveal something to someone, something X to some person Y, is not to disclose information about that thing X to that person Y. Rather, it's to make that person or that thing X become real and actual for that person Y. So that's different from our English idiom. We just don't use reveal that way. And therefore, in the end, I wouldn't translate it, and I didn't translate it reveal, because for us, when you're revealing something, you're disclosing information that would otherwise be unknown to them. That's what it means to reveal something to someone. But that's, I would argue, that doesn't seem to be exclusively the way that this word is used. In this sense of the word, in the way that I'm taking it, when an angry man punches another man in the face, he is revealing his punch to him. So it's not that he's saying, I'm going to punch you, and revealing information about it. He's actualizing, he's making the punch a reality. Or something a little bit more Christian here, when a mother kisses her infant on the cheek, a kiss on the cheek is being revealed to the infant. Now, we just plain don't use our English language that way. That's not how we use the word, but I think that's how the Greek word, that's what it means. So, to give you some evidence for that, in Romans 1:18, the very next verse, past the one we're looking at here, when it says God's wrath is being revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, God's wrath is not being talked about. It's not being foretold from heaven, I would argue. Rather, God's wrath is being directed, poured out from heaven against all unrighteousness and ungodliness of men. Now, I suppose 118 is ambiguous. That could go either way. But in the end, I'm going to argue that that's what he means. And if you'll notice the way I translate it, the wrath of God is directed from heaven against all the hatred of God and unrighteousness. A better piece of evidence, perhaps, is Romans 2:5. In Romans 2:5, the day of wrath and of the revelation of the righteous judgment of God. Clearly in that verse, I mean, there's no mistaking the fact that in that verse, the day he's talking about is not when some prophet stands up and says, boy, are you guys going to get it one day. That's not the day of the revelation of the righteous judgment of God. The day he's talking about is the day when God's wrath comes down on mankind and smashes and destroys and punishes. That's the day of the revelation of the righteous judgment of God. Well, why revelation? Because the way this Greek word is used, I would argue, it's the actual bringing into reality and actualizing that wrath in our experience. So Romans 2:5, the day of wrath and of the revelation of the righteous judgment of God, is not the day when God's righteous judgment is predicted. It is the day when God's righteous judgment comes to pass. So if I'm right about the meaning of that word, then for the dikaiosune in this verse, for the dikaiosune of God to be revealed, is for the dikaiosune of God to be brought about, to be granted, to be made a reality in a person's life. So that's the way I'm taking reveal. Now, the second piece of information is when something is revealed using the Greek term that is used here, it is typically revealed ace. We translate it to someone, but the Greek preposition that's used, if you're talking about to whom it is revealed, it's the great Greek preposition ace. Why is that relevant? Look at our literal translation. It is revealed ek pistis, ace pistis. So what that suggests to me is with the verb revealed, that second prepositional phrase, es pistis, is telling us to whom the dikaiosune of God is revealed or directed or granted or whatever. The third piece of information, it is a valid figure of speech to let an abstract quality or characteristic, sorry for the typo, stand for people who manifest that quality or characteristic. Hence, you would understand what I mean if I said kindness is returned to kindness. Clearly, I mean kindness is returned to people who act in kindness, or even people act kindly toward those who act kindly to them. Clearly, that's what I mean. Kindness is just an abstract noun that's standing in the place of concrete individuals who express that abstract noun, kindness. So in this example, the abstract noun kindness is used to denote people who are acting according to kindness. Correspondingly, in Romans 1:17, dikaiosune is not revealed literally to pistis. It's not the abstract reality of faith that dikaiosune is revealed to. Surely, Paul is saying that dikaiosune is revealed to people who have pistis. And then finally, the fourth point, later in Romans, Paul will argue repeatedly on a handful of occasions, explicitly, that a man is not rendered or made dikaios by God, ek, another preposition, by reason of his works of the law. He is rendered dikaios by God, ek, his belief, his pistis. And the Greek preposition used there that I've translated by reason of is ek. Again, notice in our literal translation, in it, the dikaiosune of God is revealed ek pistis, ace pistis. So, putting all that together, you have my interpretation at the bottom of the page. Now, in it, the dikaiosune of God is granted. Let's paraphrase it and make it more idiomatic in English. In it, the dikaiosune of God is granted to, ace, those who believe, the word is pistis, by reason of, ek, their belief, pistis. Just as it is written, the one who is dikaios by reason of, ek, his belief shall live. So, the dikaiosune of God, and we looked at that last week, It's that state of being approved by a judicial decree by God. being approved by judicial decree to be accepted into the kingdom of God one day and experience the eternal life or the shalom that is in store for those people that God approves. Well, who gets that dikaiosune, that approval to enter into life? It's granted to those who believe by virtue of the fact or by reason of the fact that they believe. And then he quotes Habakkuk, just as it is written in Habakkuk, the one who is dikaios by reason of his belief shall live, that is, shall live rather than die. Okay, I hope that's clear. That's a key assertion in the whole book of Romans here, because it's sort of at the end of the introduction, he's sort of very, very succinctly, in a very brief form, summarizing the message of the entire book, I would argue. Okay, I want now to go on into part one of the body of the letter, which I've called section three here. I just want to warn you ahead of time. This is a very, when we look at it in just one lecture, all by itself alone, this is a very depressing message. But you have to keep in mind, this is only a part of the book. He's going to go on to give us some very good news. But he gives us the good news with the bad news in the backdrop, and this section is nothing but bad news. This is the bad news that brings the goodness of the good news into the forefront and dramatizes it. We have to really, truly understand how bad the bad news is before we understand the gospel. Okay, so what does it say? The wrath of God is directed from heaven against all the hatred of God and unrighteousness present in men who suppress the truth in their unrighteousness. For what can be known about God is evident among them. God has made it evident to them. From the creation of the cosmos, his invisible attributes, both his eternal power and his deity, have been clearly seen, being understood from what was created. For this reason, they are without a defense, because while they knew God, they did not acknowledge his glory as God, nor respond in gratitude. Rather, they became unintelligent in their reasonings, and their clueless heart was darkened. Claiming to be wise, they responded like ignorant fools and swapped the glory of the incorruptible God for an image that was the representation of corruptible man, of birds, of four-footed beasts, or of crawling reptiles. For this very reason, God abandoned them to impurity and the desires of their hearts, with the result that they dishonored their own bodies among themselves. These very people swapped the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who, to be sure, is eternally praiseworthy. So God gave them over to degrading passions. Their women swapped their natural desire for sexual intimacy for a desire that was against nature. Similarly, the men, forsaking their natural desire for sexual intimacy with women, were consumed by their lust toward one another. Males, committing a shameful act with males, were bringing on themselves the penalty that is required due to their error. Inasmuch as they did not judge God worthy to include in their understanding, God abandoned them to their defective mind, with the result that they did what was not right. Abandoned to their defective mind, they were filled with all unrighteousness, with wickedness, with greed, and with evil. They became full of envy, murder, contentiousness, deceit, and malice. They became manipulative liars. They became slanderers. They became haters of God. They became insolent people with inflated egos. They became people puffed with pretense. They became inventors of evil. They became disobedient to parents. They became ignorant. They became utterly faithless and untrustworthy. They became people unaffected by normal human feeling and compassion. They became people who were implacable. They became people who utterly lacked mercy. And while they understand the demands of God's justice, that people who practice such things are worthy of death, not only do they do all these things themselves, but they also grant approval to others practicing such things. So you stand without a defense, O man, each one of you, every one of you who passes judgment. For when you condemn the other person, you bring condemnation down on yourself. For you who are condemning others do the same evil things yourself, and we know that the sentence of God rightly and truly falls upon those who do such things. Okay, let's look at it a paragraph at a time and see what he's saying in each paragraph, and then we'll come back and summarize the whole argument here. In paragraph 8, he seems to make about four different assertions here. First, his first assertion is that the evidence for the presence and reality of God as the creator of all reality is rationally compelling. He just simply asserts that. I'm going to come back to that and discuss that in a second. But he simply is asserting that in the light of what God created in the cosmos, there's something about his creation that ought to be rationally compelling to us. There ought to be no question in our mind but what there's a creator God and designer of this whole thing. So that ought to be rationally compelling, he says. But as rationally compelling as the evidence of God's creation ought to be, mankind has refused to acknowledge that evidence and its implications. And that's his second assertion. We've refused to acknowledge the evidence. We've refused to take it to its logical conclusion and bow our knee to our Creator and offer thanks to Him. Instead, mankind has invented all sorts of alternative accounts, accounts that are ultimately ignorant and unintelligent. So he's talking about this swap that we've done. We've swapped the truth that ought to be rationally compelling to us for a bunch of myths and fairy tales that we embrace and prefer, even though ultimately they are ignorant and unintelligent and stupid ideas, stupid accounts, stupid stories. But we prefer the stupid to the compelling. So, he says, mankind is without excuse for rejecting God. It's not like we are rejecting God out of some kind of innocent ignorance. We're rejecting God willfully, deliberately, stubbornly, refusing to even follow the dictates of our own rational minds. So, accordingly, mankind stands under the doom of God's impending wrath. And that's actually how he starts the paragraph. The wrath of God is directed from heaven against all the hatred of God and the unrighteousness present in men. I think that's the basic thesis statement for this whole section. What is the bad news? The bad news is that human beings, because they are human beings, have the judgment of God hovering above their head. It could come down on them and smash them at any time, rightfully, justly. Why? Because of our, I translate it, hatred of God. You could translate it impiety, but I don't know. Impiety just doesn't cut it for me. I mean, the idea is are not taking God seriously, basically, is the basic idea in the word. Because we have not taken God seriously, and because of the unrighteousness that follows from our not taking God seriously, on both counts we stand ready to be destroyed by the just God who would condemn us for that evil choice, that unrighteous rebelliousness. Okay, let me raise a couple of questions to be clear about what Paul is saying here. Is Paul saying that there's no such thing as an atheist? No, he's not saying that. Notice what he says here, against all the hatred of God and unrighteousness present in men who suppress the truth in their unrighteousness. He's not arguing that people don't sincerely, if you will, not understand that God exists. There are people who do not know that God exists, who do not believe that God exists. And yeah, they're sincere about that. Paul's point is, what a strange thing to be sincere about in view of all the evidence that's in the world. What is going on that people can sincerely not see, that they can sincerely not get it? What's going on in their lives that would lead them to that sort of perception, which is against all truth and against all reason and against all evidence? Well, his argument is, this thing, this unrighteous suppression of truth, is what is ultimately behind that. So he's not denying that we will find atheists out there, but he's just saying that those atheists have no good reason to be atheists. Is Paul saying that atheists are stupid because they're not following the evidence? No, he's not. Atheists are brilliant. They're intellectually sharp. What's perverse about atheism is their willingness to take their intellectual acuity and use it to the end of inventing reasons not to believe in God, who is the true creator. That's what's perverse. that's what's strange. That's what's weird. So we don't miss the evidence because we're not intellectually capable of seeing the evidence. We miss the evidence again because of a suppression of it. There's a moral, spiritual rebellion at the root of it. It's not an intellectual problem. It's willfulness. I will not believe the truth, not I cannot believe the truth. And then finally, we could raise the question, in saying that there is evidence for God's existence, is Paul suggesting that we can prove God's existence? My answer to that is, I think, yes and no. If you take philosophy classes at the university, the standard line that you will get is they'd look at all the traditional arguments for the existence of God, and your typical philosopher is going to say they all fail. None of those arguments succeed. Now, what do they mean by that? I think what they mean by that is each and every one of those arguments is going to find some philosopher somewhere who will poke a hole in them. That is, will, and what I mean by poke a hole in them, will show that they are not exactly airtight and rigorous and completely irrefutable. That those arguments don't cover all the bases in the sense that there's no room for question at any one of the steps of the argument. Are they right about that? Yeah, I think they're right about that. Because in the final analysis, who can construct a foolproof proof about for anything except simple issues in logic and mathematics and stuff like that? But things pertaining to metaphysics and real life and real existence, you can't construct formal proofs that can't somehow be attacked and challenged and questioned by somebody. Sure, they can be questioned. But Paul is not dealing with this question at the level of formal proofs and formal arguments. I would argue that he's dealing with this more at the level of rational intuitions. And the point I think that he's making is when you experience the cosmos that God created, doesn't the mind within us, even if at an intuitive level, not a conscious level, not a philosophical level, not at the level of formal proofs and theory, but at the level of just my gut instincts, if you will, which are ultimately and can ultimately be rational, my gut instincts can, at that level, don't I know? I mean, that's more the spirit of his argument. It's not that we don't know, we do know. We know that there is a God to whom we should bow the knee. We just don't want to. And so we spend the energy, the intellectual energy, and use our intellectual acumen to invent fables and myths that we can believe rather than the truth. I will be so bold to assert that I think 1,000 years from now, people will look back on what we study in our university and all of our stressing all the importance of the theory of evolution and laugh at us. I mean, stepping back away from it, since I don't have the pressure of academic credentials to protect here, it's a silly theory, I would argue. And that's exactly what Paul is saying here. We will take our greatest minds and train them to defend silliness rather than face into the truth of the evidence of the Creator God. It is an incredible phenomenon, but it's what mankind has been doing from the beginning. Okay, so that's his contention in paragraph 8. Let's go on to paragraph 9. In 9, his first assertion is that what he's going to do is he's going to make a statement and then he's going to restate it again in a little bit more specific form. And then he gives an example of what it is that he's just asserted. His initial assertion is that mankind's creation of idols is an excellent dramatic example of mankind's foolish, ignorant rejection of truth about God in favor of a stupid alternative. I mean, Paul just thinks that the creation of idols, carving a log into a god, or fashioning clay into a god, or pouring bronze into a statue and worshiping it, has got to be the stupidest thing that mankind has ever done. But It was universal in the time that Paul is writing, just like evolution is universal in our day. That was the universal official account that allowed us to escape bowing our knee to the real Creator. So Paul trots out idolatry as his example of how far we will go to reject, to suppress the truth and make up an alternative to it. Then he says, because mankind rejected the truth about God and created idols, God, instead of intervening at that point and setting the record straight somehow and changing man's heart and fixing the situation, instead of intervening, God forsook mankind and abandoned them to the corrupt and impure desires that follow from a rejection of God. Now, I'm not sure I have a clear answer to this question, but we can raise the question at this point. What does Paul understand to be the relationship between what in the first sentence he called impiety or a disregard for God, not taking God seriously, what I called the hatred of God, and what he calls unrighteousness? I think what he means by unrighteousness, as the chapter goes on, is all the ways in which we behave evilly, selfishly, perversely, impurely, and so on. It's just a broad term for all of human depravity in all of its forms. That's unrighteousness. Well, we're being judged for both. We're being judged for disregarding God and for the unrighteousness that follows from that. He never really spells out exactly what he thinks the relationship between those two is. But it would appear from the way the argument goes that he sees the relationship as a kind of natural one. And in the next paragraph, I think we get a better glimpse of what he's talking about. So I'll save what I think is his answer till then. But in the meantime, in this paragraph, he's just sort of taking it for granted that if you suppress the truth about God, don't honor him as God and give thanks as you should, but you tell yourself another story instead, the net result is going to be you'll be given over to degrading passions, to impure desires of various kinds. So, because mankind rejected the truth about God, God forsook mankind and abandoned them to the corrupt and impure desires that follow from a rejection of God. Then he restates that same assertion. Mankind chose to serve idols, idols that he made, rather than the God who's actually there. So God forsook him and abandoned him to the degrading passions that follow from rejecting God. He just restates that all over again. And then he follows that with an example of what he thinks is a degrading passion of the kind that he's talking about. And namely, homosexuality is the dramatic example of a degrading passion to which mankind was given over when God gave him over to the foolishness of his rebellion. Okay. Now, what are we to make of that? What exactly is Paul saying about homosexuality here? Is he saying that homosexuality is more perverse than other sins we commit? No, I don't think so. His point here is not to kind of single out homosexuality as the depths of moral degradation, or the most evil of the evil that we spiral down to. A lot of people read the passage that way. But I think that's to misunderstand the structure of the argument. I think he brings up homosexuality because the point that he wants to make is, what has happened because God has abandoned man to go his own way? He's become stupid and foolish and ignorant, on the one hand, and he's been given over to degrading passions. Okay? What kind of evidence can he cite for that? Well, he could cite, it would still be true if he talked about selfishness and lying and dishonesty and injustice and a lack of mercy and a lack of compassion. All of those things are perverse as well. And I dare say Paul would say they are equally perverse. And sometimes they are perverse in a way that they have even greater consequences than homosexuality does. All that stuff is perverse. But the problem with those things, for the sake of his argument, is they are so commonplace, and they are so universal, and they are so ordinary, and we have become so accustomed to them and even desensitized to them, that we almost think they're normal. We don't, try to call somebody perverse for being selfish, and they'll get mad at you. What do you mean calling me perverse? Let me beat you up. because their response is, well, look, I mean, everybody is that way. I mean, I'm not any more bent and distorted than anybody else around me. Don't be calling me perverse. And yet that's exactly, I think, the biblical message, is that this is the way we live our lives, the way we experience our lives, and the way we conduct ourselves is a twisted form of humanity. We are not good people. We are not normal human beings. We are not the human beings that God created us to be. We are a distortion of what God created us to be in all of those respects. But all of those things are hard to make hard to cite as evidence for Paul's case. But homosexuality is different, because homosexuality is, in a sense, a degree more shameless than all those other sins. It's not more perverse, but it is more shameless, because there's the whole obvious screaming reality of biological nature telling us how inappropriate it is. Now, I know that falls on deaf ears in our culture today. I know that. I'm not totally dumb and blind. But the fact of the matter is, the truth is, if we could get some objectivity on our culture, get outside of our culture, and remove the cultural lenses that are given to us, and just think about it for a second, it only stands to reason that if God's creation really does have purpose, as we Christians believe that it does, and God was a rational God, as we believe that he was, and that he created a rational creation, as we believe that he did, and that creation is full of purpose and order and structure to it, then there's no escaping the fact that God intended for sexuality and reproduction, and I would argue in the final analysis, marriage, to go together. That's a harder call. We'd have to have a longer discussion. But it seems to me that the nature of the human, the evidence we have from the human psyche, as well as biology more mundanely, is that God intended men and women to commit their lives to one another, to create an environment to bring children into the world and nurture them into the world. I mean, that, is there any question but what that's what God intended in the created order? And Paul would say, no, of course there's no question about that. So when we fly in the face of that, we're being particularly shameless in our rebellion against what God intended and what God purposed. So in that regard, homosexuality, therefore, is a very striking and dramatic example of the lengths to which we will stand before God and go, no, you don't know what you're doing. You know what you're talking about. We can do it our own way, and we can do it better. The very kind of rebellion that he's trying to indicate here. But it's not more perverse. It's not more depraved. It's not more sinful. It's not more evil. It's just more obviously perverse. It's not more deeply perverse, but it's more obvious that it's perverse. And so it becomes the example of all perversion for him here, I think. A second thing that we can ask about this paragraph is the fact that Paul brings up the example of idolatry as for our depraved and foolish mind, and homosexuality as an example of our degrading passions and unrighteousness. Does that mean he's talking here to heathens and about heathens? Because these wouldn't have been prevalent within Judaism of this time, neither of these. So is this a paragraph that pertains only to heathens? I don't think so. If I'm understanding the structure of his argument here, part one, or section three, is to human beings as human beings, Jew and Gentile alike. He's giving us a snapshot of humanity here. Now, when we get to section four, what I'm going to argue is the very reason he writes section four is he recognizes the predilection of Jews to say, yeah, aren't those barbarians and heathens awful? But we're Jews. And so he's going to turn in section four to them and say, I'm talking about you. I'm not just talking about the heathens as much as I am talking about the heathens, but I'm not just talking about the heathens. I have described you in the last paragraph, not them. So even though the examples come out of the heathen world, it's because they are particularly dramatic, his point is not about the heathens. His point is about humanity. And in this day and age, you know, we need to take that to heart, and this will be more important in the next section. We as Christians have the same tendency. We as Christians tend to think that these passages are not talking to me. This is talking to the pagans out there, not to we who are Christians. And Paul would have the same rejoinder. What, you think you're going to escape the judgment of God because you go to the Baptist church? You think you're going to escape the judgment of God because you read your Bible? Give me a break. Look at your life, he's going to say. But we'll get there next week. But nobody is accepted from this snapshot of humanity here. Nobody. Okay, then we get to paragraph 10. And what is he going to say in paragraph 10? Man, suppressing the truth, judged God to be irrelevant and uninteresting, not worthy to be known and understood. The word he uses is adokimos. And I don't remember where I got this. I hope this is true. I hope it's not one of those Bible myths. But I remember years ago running across this piece of information that apparently they have shards from the making of pottery back in the old days. And on those shards, they will have written an alpha or a delta, I believe. Maybe that's only an alpha. And I don't know how they know this, but the alpha stands for adokimos, and the delta is for dokimos. A pot is either adokimos or it is dokimos. And adokimos means it's been fired in the kiln and has come out sound. It is a sound vessel. It doesn't leak, doesn't have any cracks in it. An adokimos vessel is something that is cracked when it was fired in the kiln. That's the word he uses here, that because you did not judge God as dokimos, God has given you over to an adokimos mind. So it's a play on words here. Because you judged God as somehow unworthy and unacceptable and it's with respect to your having him in your understanding, and the way I've translated or the way I've understood it is to be, you've judged him to be irrelevant to your life. You've judged him to be uninteresting. You've judged him to be not worth knowing, not worth bringing into your understanding of what you want to understand about your life and reality. Because you have judged him adokimos in that regard with respect to your understanding, he gave you over to an adokimos mind. That is, a mind that is disqualified to be called a mind, basically. A mind that doesn't function. A mind that is broken. A mind that has become degraded somehow. This has an important implication, the fact that God gave us over to a mind that is degraded. Because man was not allowing himself to think straight about God, he says. He had to pervert the very character and function of his own rationality in order to avoid submitting to and thanking God, his creator. I mean, God was doing a number on his whole head in order to avoid believing in God. Well, I think the point that Paul's making is, by doing a number on his own head, and God didn't intervene to fix the situation, he abandoned him to that depraved mind, the result of man suppressing the truth about God is that mankind did everything that was not right. And I think the connection between impure desires, degrading passions, and the foolishness of the human mind, I think the relationship is, you can't do a number on your head to avoid believing in God without that having consequences for whether your head can think straight about every other issue of your life. You have twisted and perverted your own rationality. You can't see straight, you can't think straight, there is no wisdom in you. You threw away wisdom in order to not have to face your Creator. I think that must be how he's understanding the connection between them. So then Paul goes into this long description of the many ways in which man, living with a depraved mind, does what is not right. And then you just have this long litany of things. He first summarizes all unrighteousness with these three terms, wickedness, greed, and evil. They're pretty general terms. But then he fills out some more specific examples. They became full of envy, murder, contentiousness, deceit, and malice. I mean, notice in that list, we may escape the murder charge, but the rest of them hit us square in the bullseye. I mean, who of us can say that we have not experienced this other stuff? That's us. Our depraved mind has made us not see straight and think straight about our lives, and so we become full of these attributes here. They became manipulative liars, slanderers, haters of God, insolent people with inflated egos, people puffed with pretense, inventors of evil. That's the one I love. I mean, if there's anything on this list that highlights the fact that we're not just talking about moral weakness, we're not just talking about not being strong enough to do the good thing. We don't stop at not doing the good thing, Paul says. We actually invent new forms of evil. We actually invent new perversions. We invent kinky new ways to live our lives. This is not moral weakness. This is a wholesale rejection and twisting of everything good. They became disobedient to parents. They became ignorant. They became utterly faithless and untrustworthy. People unaffected by normal human feeling and compassion. The other thing that's shocking to me today in our culture, as we lose the effects of Christianity, the things that parents these days are doing to their children is just nauseating. And if you have anything left in you of normal human feeling and compassion, you go, how do you do that? How does a person get themselves so twisted around that they can sexually abuse their own children, torture their own children, mentally, physically, and so on? And that stuff is going on out there. This is what he's describing. I mean, we become so twisted and perverse that we're not even affected any longer by the built-in mechanisms, the built-in instincts that ought not to be hard, because it's not even a moral choice. It's just instinct. We even destroy our own instinctual love for our own children or in our own family and so on. They became people who were implacable. That's not in all the texts. Not sure whether that should be there or not, but I'm going with it. They became people who were implacable. I think if it does belong in the text, I think it works with the next one. They became people who utterly lacked mercy. I think the point he's making by implacable, maybe implacable is not the best translation, but where we become so bent on revenge that nothing is going to placate us. The other person needs to die. The other person needs to hurt. There is no mercy for them. That again, the depth of our perversion. And while they understand the demands of God's justice, that people who practice such things are worthy of death, not only do they do all these things themselves, but they also grant approval to others practicing such things. That's the other thing that's really strange. Who are the people that become famous, who become celebrities, who become the people we champion in our culture? Oftentimes, it's the people who are most shameless in their perversion. The Howard Sterns, the Bill Clintons, with respect to his issues. I mean, it's not just that we tolerate them. It's not just that we understand them. It's not just that we, you know, kind of let it go. We actually are proud of them because they have the audacity to fly in the face of that which is good and right and pure and true, and do the shameless things themselves and defend it. And we applaud them for it. That's exactly what Paul is describing here. So, implicitly, he doesn't say this explicitly, but what is his point there? It goes way back to the thesis that he started this section. Hence, the wrath of God is directed from heaven against us all. Because every one of us who can class ourselves among the set of those people who are human beings, every one of us has opted for a depraved mind and therefore are given over to the degrading passions that follow from that. And what does that mean then? God's wrath, the doom of God's destruction, hangs over our heads. Okay, then finally, paragraph 11, what does he say? You, he then points the finger, he's getting very dramatic here, you, whoever you are, if you are a human being, you stand condemned. And then how does he know that? I mean, the reason you stand condemned because you've suppressed the truth about God and have pursued the unrighteousness that follows from suppressing the truth. But how does he know that? Well, he says, you can readily discern how truly damnable, how truly worthy of condemnation is the behavior of the other people around you. You see that clear as day. But you have to understand the implication of that. If you see as clear as day that those people are behaving damnably, that they're behaving in a way that's worthy of condemnation, then you have to understand then that you stand condemned because you do the same stuff that they're doing. Now, he doesn't mean by that, when you condemn a murderer, you stand condemned because you're a murderer too. Well, I may not be. No, of course not. But the same thing that makes murder damnable makes my hatred damnable. The same thing that makes adultery damnable makes my faithlessness to keep my promises damnable. It's the same stuff. And if it's damnable in the one case, it's damnable in my case. And so Paul's saying, look, we know how to judge rightly. That's no secret to us. That's no mystery to us. We do it. We have a great facility with discerning right and wrong and knowing what the implications of that are when we're looking at other people. We just go kind of stupid when we start looking at ourselves. He says, don't do that. Apply the same discernment and the same profound insight into our relationship with God to yourself that you use when you're evaluating other people. Evaluate yourself the same way. And so, therefore, since we all stand condemned, the wrath of God is directed from heaven against us all. And that's the implicit conclusion to this whole section. In the bottom line of all he's trying to say in section 3 is, we are under the doom of God's condemnation and destruction. Because that then is going to be the backdrop for the good news when he finally gets around to telling us that. Okay, what do we do in chapter 11 with a lot of people are going to respond, doesn't the Bible teach us to judge not lest you be judged? How do we fit that with what Paul is saying here? In fact, people will often look at this, my sentence too here, for when you condemn the other person, you bring condemnation down on yourself. They just read that in isolation and say, see, you are damnable if you judge other people. If you condemn other people, you are damnable. It's not what he's saying. If you read the paragraph carefully, that's not what he's saying. He's not saying, if you condemn other people, shame on you, you're damnable for that. What he's saying is, if you rightly condemn other people, and you are rightly condemning other people, but if you do that and don't turn that same sentence of condemnation on yourself, shame on you. Because whether you like it or not, the standard that you're applying to other people must be and will be applied to you as well. So dig it. That's the way God is going to look at it. Okay. Everywhere that the Bible talks about judgment, it's not to say don't judge. That is to say, he's not saying don't be discerning, don't make judgments, don't recognize that people's actions is damnable. It's not ever prohibiting us from doing that. In fact, in the book of Hebrews, we should, through practice, train our senses to discern good and evil. We should practice judging every day of our lives. We should be well practiced at it. The evil is when in our self-righteousness, we don't practice it on ourselves. That's the evil. Okay, so that's the section. Let's see, can we sum this up? To sum it up, man stands condemned. Man, out of hostility to God, refused to acknowledge him. It was inexcusable, but he did it. That is, he refused to acknowledge him. God did not intervene. He let man go his way. The rejection of God naturally led to all sorts of unrighteous perversion in his life and behavior. Accordingly, man's practicing of unrighteousness is the concrete manifestation of his rejection of God. So, as a consequence, no matter who we are, we all stand condemned, for every single one of us practices the unrighteousness that follows from rejecting God. And that's the argument of the section.
In the list of things that people do that are sins, you have one in part four. they became ignorant. What exactly is the sin of that one? Or what's underlying that word?
I'm just assuming it's a repetition of the kind of ignorance that he's been talking about in the whole section. If it's not that, then I don't know what it is. But I'm assuming it's just the propensity to not follow the truth where it leads, but instead to go where I want to go, and therefore remain in my ignorance. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, he doesn't help us any. It's just the plain old ordinary word for not knowing, for not having understanding.
I don't remember what you said about this last time, but you were talking about how you were saying, well, because you're a Jew, don't assume that you are exempt from any of these things that I'm talking about here. I thought you were saying something last time about him being, addressing the Gentiles. Who were you saying that he was addressing the book to, and how, because he was talking about Gentiles at the beginning of the book, why is he talking about them there? And then you're saying he's making an argument from people's Jewish ideas here.
Okay. I may not remember every aspect of your question, but I think he's addressing the question primarily to, well, the book is a very, very Jewish book in its in the themes that it's going to pick up before all is said and done. Now, having said that, that doesn't tell us that the book is to Jews, because it could very well be to Gentile God-fearers. In the Roman Empire at this time, as the Roman Empire became less and less, more and more morally degraded, more and more people turned to Judaism and took a good hard look at Judaism, because it was a far more substantial faith than the kind of polytheism and paganism that they were surrounded by. And so there would be a lot of Gentiles who wouldn't actually proselytize to Judaism. They wouldn't become Jews. But they would go to synagogue, and they would listen to the reading of the scriptures, and they would discuss and dialogue with people about the meaning of the scriptures. And for all practical purposes, in terms of their training and their education, they became Jewish in their education. But they weren't practicing Jews. They couldn't, because they weren't circumcised and they had not proselytized. A lot of those God-fearers became Christian believers when they heard the gospel. So what I would surmise is that what we have in Rome is a combination of Jews who have accepted the truth that Jesus is the Messiah, and a whole lot of Gentile God-fearers who have accepted the fact that Jesus is the Messiah, and they're in some kind of community together. There is a Jewish opponent of Paul kind of in the background of the letter, but I don't think the opponent of Paul is one of the recipients of the letter. I don't think it's the Jews to whom he's writing that are objecting to his gospel. I think these are Jews who have come out of Jewish culture. Their parents are Jews. They don't believe that Jesus is the Messiah, and they're having ongoing daily attacks by the rest of Jewish culture on their belief in the gospel. And I think in large part, Paul is writing the letter to give the Christian believers, these Jewish believers, the intellectual resources to be able to answer the challenge of the larger Jewish community, the hostile Jewish community. So I think that's what gives the book its Jewish flavor, is a combination of it's under attack by the larger Jewish community, and there are a significant number of the readership that are Jews, and it's not inappropriate to have a Jewish flavor if you're talking to Gentiles, if those Gentiles are God-fearers, because they're basically Jewish in education. Now, did that respond to all your... Did I miss...
That addressed everything except for what is his argument, or why is he talking about his apostleship to the Gentiles in the beginning of the book? What's the point he's trying to make with that? And how is that connected with the Jews?
I can only guess, but I'm just guessing that there's a substantial enough Gentile component to the church in Rome, mm-hmm. that he sees it appropriate that he come and minister to the Gentiles there. But I'm just guessing. I'm not sure.
Can you talk to the issue, probably the most common way I've heard chapter 1 taught is it's kind of a historical progression or regression or whatever you want to call it, of perversion. Can you talk to that issue? Whether you
well,
think that
I'm not sure how to argue my case exactly. It's just that I don't think that's what's going on. And I don't think that's what's going on because I think I see the argument that he's making and how he's making the argument, and the argument that he's making and how he's structuring the argument does not imply that or require that. So there's such a different way of looking at it, I'm not sure how to make a case one way or the other. It's just one has to choose what is he doing here and what's going on here. I mean, he doesn't really have anything to... It doesn't make sense to me. It doesn't seem plausible to me that Paul is arguing in Romans that somehow we are more morally degraded than they were earlier. And we're talking about God destroying the world before the flood and Sodom and Gomorrah. And I mean, there's all kinds of degradation and perversity that's happened in the human race that predated the time of Paul. So I don't think it's a historical sinking into greater and greater darkness and depravity. I think this is the course of every individual's life. That I, as an individual, I reject God, and because I reject God, I do a number on my own head that ultimately ends up in being given over to degrading passions of all kinds.
Do you see that as progressive? Yeah, as progressive.
Well, I think it stands to reason that it would be. And it could be. I don't know that he's emphasizing that point. I'm not sure that that's actually germane to the argument. But certainly it stands to reason that when you're talking about people becoming inventors of evil, you can become more and more shameless in how willing you are to rebel against God. So, yeah, I think there can be a progression. I think we see that in our own culture. I mean, I think American culture is becoming progressively perverse morally, shameless in our unrighteousness.
On the whole list there, do you see any correlation, couplets of themes or anything that are related, or are they just sort of random?
I'm just assuming it's pretty much stream of consciousness. His mind is just ranging over human behavior and just picking up aspects of human behavior that he knows and believes is perverse, and I don't think there's any necessary structure to it. I mean, as in all stream of consciousness, you may have one or two things where the first one suggested the second one, which suggested the second one, but then you have this other completely different idea, and that takes them off on another train of thought. Now, maybe there's a structure to it that I'm just not seeing, but at this point, I think it's just stream of consciousness.
I just wanted to clarify something that you said. You said that when people are given over to their own mind, that they can't think clearly on anything at all. And I'm sure that you didn't mean that.
Right.
The way I'm taking it. So what did you mean?
How are you taking it?
Well, I mean, what occurs to me is that there's some really awful people out there who know a lot about, like, good, healthy foods.
Good what?
You know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of people... Food.
Oh, okay. Yeah, thank you. That's a helpful question. Thank you. I mean, it sort of goes along with my comment about atheists are not stupid. They're brilliant. I mean, they're very sharp intellectually, but, I mean, not all of them, but some of them are. It's not a matter of intellectual... It's not a matter of our intellectual equipment being defective. It's a matter of our heart being stubborn and rebellious. Well, we are quite prepared to follow the truth wherever it leads and be very, very bright and intelligent about the truth if it doesn't threaten us. So how, you know, diet, nutrition, mathematics, physics, chemistry, biology, there's a lot of disciplines, a lot of academic disciplines where we can delve into them thoroughly and rationally and objectively and intelligently, and we're not going to get anywhere that obviously says to me, you need to bow your knee to God. And because it does not clearly imply to me you need to bow your knee to God, I'm quite comfortable allowing rationality to be rational and following the evidence wherever it leads. It's only when the line of reasoning is going to take me to there is a creator God who's one day going to be your judge and you're going to be answered to him as your judge, that I don't like. And because I don't like that part, I'm going to find some way to take a quick left turn somewhere in my reasoning before I allow myself to get to that conclusion. And in fact, what we do is we use our intellectual acuity to find a clever, plausible explanation for why it doesn't imply that there's a God and I will have to stand before him as my judge one day. And we'll work really hard and use that intelligence that is working just fine, use that to perverse ends, namely to avoid the truth rather than to find the truth. Well, that's the depravity, that we would use the tools and the resources that God gave me to find the truth as a tool for avoiding the truth. That's perverse. But yeah, but no, our minds function all too well. That's not the issue.
Now I'll probably demonstrate how my mind is not functioning well. But
well, I have already. So
can you talk about? I know there's an idea, not a bad one, I don't think, about God, a picture of God that I've talked to people about, where we see God, God's kindness in having given us the gift, always held out the good gifts to us, like first in the creation and the Garden of Eden, and man chose to sin, and it's like, you know, oh, he rejected that gift, and then in Christ coming and dying for our sins, that gift being held out to everyone, but people rejecting it. And in this passage, it can sound like then God not only is just, oh darn, they rejected my gift, but then going another step and giving us over to the depravity of our minds. Is that somehow in contradiction to an idea of God holding out a gift to everyone that we just simply reject?
No, I don't think so. It's a bit problematic to try to understand what he means by giving them over. I've translated abandoned them. But the reason I translated abandoned them is because I don't think it's talking about what God is doing proactively. You know, God is not, in terms of the argument of this chapter, it's not that God is taking somebody who has pure desires and making them have impure desires just because he's mad at them. You know, they rejected him, and in a hissy fit, he's going to give them impure desires or something like that. I mean, that you could read it that way, but I don't think that's the idea. What I tried to argue is the impure desires follow somehow, they're connected somehow, and follow naturally from the choice we have made. We have rebelled against God. We have suppressed the truth. We have given ourselves over to a depraved mind. And so what did God do in response? I mean, logically, God could have at that point intervened somehow. He could have fixed the problem. But the point he's making is he didn't. He just let it go. He let our giving ourselves over to a depraved mind kind of follow its natural course and go to its natural consequences. Now, it's important to realize he doesn't mean this in an absolute sense, I don't think. Because Jesus is very much God not abandoning us to our depraved mind. If you see what I'm saying. I mean, this is not the end of the story. So this is only, relatively speaking, that he abandoned mankind to a depraved mind. And I think it's relatively speaking, because I think what he's wanting to say is God didn't step in prematurely and prevent man from reaching the depravity that we now see him in. God let him reach the depravity that we sink into the depravity that we now see him in. Then he responded. You know, he's responding to the depravity of man with the good news of the gospel that we'll get to in a couple chapters. But so God didn't ultimately abandon us to hopelessness, but he didn't prematurely step in and keep depravity from running its course first. Does that Does that make sense?
I understand how this description applies to all of us, Jew and Gentile alike, but I thought at one point you said also believer and unbeliever, and so I was wondering in what sense did you mean believer? Just when I think of the term haters of God, and so I just would like you to maybe clarify that for me.
Okay. What I meant, we'll talk a whole lot more about that when we get later in the chapter and talk about our sanctification, but in terms of the basic fundamental underlying proclivity of our lives, this describes us even as believers. As believers, we can find ourselves attracted to the kind of foolishness, to the kind of degrading passions and impure desires that any human being on the planet. Now, we have another reality also at work in us, namely the Spirit waging war against the flesh. But I think this chapter is describing what Paul will later call our flesh. That in my flesh, Paul will say in Romans chapter 7, we are sold into bondage to sin. I think right along the lines of what this describes. Is that?
Would you say that some folks in the Christian church would say that this might apply to unbelievers, and after you become a believer, it does not apply?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So are you also kind of addressing that?
Yeah, I would certainly take issue with that theology. It's I think that's where our wishful thinking affects our theology. We would want the message of the gospel to be, come to Jesus and he'll fix you and you won't be a sinner any longer. I mean, who wouldn't want that to be the gospel? But as it happens, that's not what the gospel is saying. That's not the good news. We do become new creatures. He does sanctify us, that's true, and we'll talk about that later. But sanctification and becoming new creatures does not mean that we transcend our humanity and so overcome and arise above our humanity that we completely eliminate this kind of proclivity in our lives. No, it doesn't happen here.
He's addressing this letter to the Romans, and there are believers. So he's speaking to Jews and Gentiles. He's speaking to believers. Wouldn't this hit them really hard then, just like it might hit the believing church at large? I mean, if...
Well, I should think so, yeah. I would think so, and it should. I mean, this is a very unattractive part of the truth of the gospel. We don't like this, but it's true. And part of our sanctification, part of the coming to really evidence the fact that God is doing a work in our life and that we really belong to him and we really are his children, is our swallowing this truth about ourselves.
Yeah, I guess when I was thinking about this question, what hit me was, if Paul is speaking to believers in the Roman church and he's saying this to them, I wonder if the same kinds of issues that are current in the church today, I mean, if there's a similar kind of mindset, because we have such a hard time facing into the depths of our depravity. I mean, if he's saying this to first century Romans, it sounds like they're having the same issues as the church today.
Right, because what's going to be implicit in his argument is the alternative that the Jewish culture is giving them is that you're not that bad, just stop disobeying the law and start obeying the law. And then God will be merciful to you because you've given it, you've made a good effort and you've started to obey the law. And Paul's going to say, what? Are you kidding me? How are you going to obey the law if you really understand what the law requires? To really understand what the law requires means that you fall on your face before God and say, and what I really want to say, I can't say, but you say, I'm in deep trouble, God. I'm in really big trouble, God. Help me. Be merciful to me. I can't do this. The demands of your laws are so pure, are so it is such righteousness that you want from me that I can't do it. I can't be that person.
I was wondering, piggybacking on what Denise was saying, if what has led to that particular mindset has something to do with the interesting intermingling of these proselyte Gentiles into this Jewish culture that so has such a mindset on legalism, on law, which would be very akin to our culture today,
right,
with having cultural Christianity, right, a Phariseeism type situation. Because it is really interesting to see that there is such a similarity.
Yeah, the parallel is very striking. No, I think you're exactly right.
Chuck, in paragraph 9, sentence 5, it reads, males committing a shameful act with males were bringing on themselves the penalty that is required due to their error.
Mm-hmm.
Is that an immediate penalty or a future penalty?
Good question. You often have Christians look at that and say AIDS or some homosexual lifestyle-specific penalty that is God's judgment on the homosexual for his homosexuality. I don't think that's at all what he's saying. I think the penalty that is required due to their error is the same penalty that is due to everyone who's given over to a depraved mind with degrading passions in whatever form that takes, and the due penalty for their error is the wrath of God, is their judgment one day. I think that's all he's saying. Because the purpose of the paragraph is it's constructed to be examples of what he's already claimed. And what is it that he's already claimed? We're under the wrath of God. Why are we under the wrath of God? We suppress the truth. What happened when we suppressed the truth? God abandoned us to the natural consequences of that, and we were given over to degrading passions. And that's why we're under the wrath of God. And that's what he's said already. And now he's giving examples of that. We are, for example, how did we suppress the truth of God? We worshipped idols instead of God. And what did he do? He gave us over to degrading passions. Like what? Like homosexuality. So what was the consequence? He gave us over to the due penalty for our error, or gave them over to the due penalty for their error. But I think it's the same due penalty for all of us. It's the judgment, the wrath of God.
Hey, Jack. I just have a question about your translation in section 10. It says, unaffected by normal human feeling and compassion. And I liked how you explained that, but I just wanted to understand your translation from unloving and unforgiving into that phrase. So I just how you got that, how you got to that conclusion.
The unloving is like are you in the New American Standard or the NIV or?
Yeah, NIV, I think.
NIV, okay. Well, it's just one Greek word, but if you'll look it up in a lexicon, it's not what you would normally expect for unloving. It's not the negation of the typical word for loving. It's a particular word that has to do with the kind of love that's instinctual between human beings. So I just tried to make that explicit in my translation. Okay, thank you very much.